You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do. So she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode is brought to you by our patrons, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek, and Ari Ashkenazi.
Hello and welcome to the Mythgreen Podcast. I'm your host, Wes, and with me is...
Chris.
And...
Oren.
And today we're talking about how to GM, DM, or just control the environment in your role-playing games. So, Oren, Chris, let's start off with the most important question. What is your favorite role-playing environment?
Usually like my living room with like some pizzas, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you say environment, do you mean like what type of... like town versus countryside, or
yeah, let's break this up into several ways. Let's start with you can have urban, a wilderness, or underground.
Hmm.
Oh man, it's like my children. I love them all, or I love whichever one is doing more chores for me at the moment. Like, I think I'm probably more partial to urban.
Uh-huh.
Like, I've done a lot of my best work in urban RPGs, but at the same time, like, I definitely get the appeal of, like, wilderness games, and Mouse Guard might be my favorite RPG of all time, and that's all about the wilderness mm-hmm. game, right? And then, like, underground dungeon stuff, I really used to have no time for it at all until I started playing Torchbearer and suddenly dungeons were fun again. Mm. And it was like, this is amazing and magical.
Right. Mm-hmm. Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why I would lean towards urban is just because I think I like interacting with the NPCs.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the urban environment is what has like lots of NPCs to interact with. And I definitely find some appeal in the classic D&D, you know, head out into the wilderness and who knows what we'll find there or what encounters we'll have, mm-hmm. you know. But I would say by default, urban would be my choice. Because, yeah, then you can sort of have also the same group of people around that you can build relationships with. And, you know, and if you want, like, you can get to know an area really well, like have like a town map or something. And that, I think that's cool, too.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm just kind of curious because like I agree with you guys. Like I've the better, more enjoyable campaigns that I've like run and participated in have been urban based. And then I wonder if there's just something kind of daunting about like the openness of like the wilderness, you know, like a dungeon like is kind of a confined space and there's less things for a GM to, you know, worry about managing, you know, like the weather's not going to change on you in a dungeon. And similarly with like a town or a city, like you're kind of confined to like within that space. It's not like rolling hills and should I introduce a thunderstorm or is it muddy or are there wild antelope all over the place? You know, like it feels like the wilderness.
The answer is always yes. Always wild antelope. All over
tame
the
them. New companions.
So- related to that, I feel like the trouble that I have when it comes to thinking about depicting, like, wilderness is if I go out hiking, for instance,
mm-hmm.
like, it's really actually pretty incredible, you know, to see what it's really like to be in that kind of landscape and go over one hill and see this thing, but I never can figure out how to make a campaign while you're traveling over the wilderness feel like that, to feel as interesting and unique and exploratory as it feels like to be out in the wilderness in person. And to me, there's always something disappointing about that. You know, like maybe it's just that all of the sensory input is essential for conveying that actual like interesting wilderness experience. I'm not sure.
I think I've had exactly one one-shot where I have successfully like communicated the majesty of a setting, and it was like that one Lord of the Rings one shot that we played, and I was like just throwing out all of Tolkien's words about like glades and stuff. So I get you. I do think there are some advantages to the wilderness scenario. One of them is that there are fewer people around, and like even though having more people around gives you more people to talk to, the more people around, the harder it is to justify why the PCs are important.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can do it. I've run a lot of urban games and had a lot of fun doing them, but you have to work harder. It's like, okay, there's a city. And, like, there's a big threat to the city. Like, a golem is loose from the factory. And it's like, does the city not have other people who are interested in not having a golem rampaging around? Mm. You know, like, is there a city watch? Are there, like, just people with guns or swords or whatever? You know, it's like, why are we important? Whereas, like, if you run a wilderness campaign, it's like, well, there are a lot fewer people around. And, like, we're important because we happen to be here. Also, like, it's harder to justify there being giant monsters wandering around in a city, except that the real monster is man, but, you know, like, but, like, the actual monsters, not metaphorical monsters. It's harder to have those in a city.
Those kind of open world environments just kind of introduce a lot of, well, I guess, headaches and concerns for GMs, because, like, I mean, you could... Like, the wilderness, for example, like, that's more often than not just part of the journey, but, like, the destination is the town, or the destination is the cave, or, you know, like, there's something there, and so if you're going to use that environment, like, you could do, like, a hour-by-hour check-in, or, like, have them make rolls, or you kind of end up doing, like, maybe you just skip it and do some kind of, like, travel montage. I guess it's, like... I know that I myself like lean towards the travel montage just because I like struggle with making it relevant. I don't want to like randomly enforce environmental penalties or have to deal with like fatigue or hunger or rations or things like
that.
Because it seems like that might not be like meaningful for my players to worry about whether or not their characters have like armor rash and are tired, you know? Like.
Yeah, none of us are survivalists, probably not anyway, so it's like asking your players to plan for a wilderness adventure like they are survivalists is not going to go over particularly well. Mm-hmm. And like, frankly, in most systems, like, nobody wants to track rations. Like, just nobody wants to do that. And if you have, like, if you start trying to get your players to do that, most of them will just lie to you. And then, like, the one player who doesn't is going to get penalized because they were actually truthful about running out of rations. I was going to say, there are exceptions. I mean, again, not to routinely bring up Torchbearer, but Torchbearer actually makes ration counting fun. At least, you know, it not for everybody, but I think it does a pretty good job. And, like, for... When I'm describing, like, you know, environmental obstacles, I usually, there has to be one of two things. One, those environmental obstacles have to be directly tied into something that's very relevant and very, like, dramatically interesting. Like, I, you know, I'm probably not going to have my characters just get, like, have to deal with a storm. It's probably going to be, like, you guys get ambushed by bandits and it's storming, right? Or something like that. Alternatively, if... the environment is part of the novelty of the game, like with Mouse Guard, where everything is different because you're mice, that's like an exception, right? Like, that's a thing where, like, if you're Mouse Guard, just like having a lot of rain changes everything when you're a
mm-hmm.
mouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, here's what I'm wondering. Like, I think for me, one of the big questions is making it feel like the players, when they're playing, are actually in an environment similar to prose writing, where if you don't do anything to describe the environment, when it feels like in the story the characters are just like floating in a void, mm-hmm. you know. And
yeah.
I think that in role-playing games it's similar, although what tends to happen is that, you know, because the environment is interactive, it maybe you don't have quite so much of the problem with the void. At the same time, in a role-playing game, if something doesn't have a mechanical effect, it just doesn't feel quite as real. It feels, it's like on a different, a level of less real than something that actually changes the likelihood of success in some way, or, you know, alters what dice they roll, et cetera, et cetera. And so one thing I would have to say about having, and obviously you guys don't seem to be a fan of just having or, you know, random penalties based on the environment. And so maybe that's not how you would implement it. But having something where, hey, you know, you go out today and you're trying to scout around, but it's really rainy and windy and the water keeps blowing in your eyes. And so you can't, you know, roll as much, or you have some kind of mechanical effect when you're trying to look out for enemies. It's because I think that that adds a realness to the fact that the players are out in the wilderness outside that just wouldn't exist unless you had some mechanical changes.
Yeah, I guess if there's going to be some kind of like proper mechanical change, like my issue is when I feel like I suddenly remember that like they're outdoors and so that this can happen, or I've participated in games where it seems like a penalty suddenly gets enforced. And I think probably the better way to do that is to like really connect it to what's going on. You know, like if the mission or whatever the quest is that this small town has been experiencing a drought, you know, and it's an unnatural drought, then that's clear from the beginning that they could probably expect to have to like ration water and suffer from like heat fatigue or heat stroke or things like that. And so it's like, if it's part of the story, if it's part of like the plot of the adventure, then like that opens like a way to do it consistently and deliberately, you know, as opposed to like, oh, they're outdoors now, like maybe it's time for hail to show up or something, you know, that's less mm-hmm. believable.
Okay, so what I usually try to do is tie it to whatever it is they're doing. Like, if they, like you mentioned, if they're scouting around, it's like, okay, if the characters are going to go out and like look for something, then the weather in like influencing them, that makes that harder, right? So that interacts with whatever their plot relevant goal is. And that part, it's at that point, it's a little bit easier to make them care about it. And like my preferred method is to have the players roll to overcome the weather, as opposed to having the weather like inflict some kind of penalty. Just because penalties that are not like really baked into the system are harder to keep track of. And they are, you know, frankly, players just react better to something they can roll against than something that just like takes away their dice or whatever. Like that. So like, I'm not saying that you should never have environmental penalties. I like to be sparing with them.
Well, it's also good to know, like, obviously know your players and know their characters. And if everybody wants to be rangers and druids, then realize that like they might actually enjoy like using their skills to overcome like environmental challenges in those ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think there might also be a problem with almost foreshadowing, you know, because I think the last thing you want is to feel like, if you're trying to make the environment feel real, to feel like, oh, I roll the dice and now there's hail. You know, like they're just a hail. Now, okay, granted, with hail, it does tend to kind of come out of nowhere, right? Like that's a thing. Hail just suddenly, at least in the Seattle area, hail suddenly appears. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you don't want to feel that like that will sort of defeats the point of having an environment that feels like the players are in. And so I wonder how much of it is that, you know, the timing. And like, for instance, if they're just leaving the inn and they step outside and then you describe, oh yeah, the weather is terrible, you know, that might be different than, you know, you're like, okay, well, you're on your way to this city and then at this point the weather's terrible, right? Because it feels like that shouldn't be sudden and it is. Mm-hmm. And how mm-hmm. much if you had bad the weather, if you set up that you saw dark clouds on the horizon first, whether that might in some ways feel better than now there's a storm.
Yeah, it like you want to, ideally you want the, and that's just, if you're trying to make the environment feel real, you want the players to feel like they are seeing it the way their characters would see it. And so if you tell them, oh, but and now there's a storm, it's like they're gonna be like, wait, did we not see like clouds on the horizon? Mm-hmm. Like, or did we not feel it getting colder, or like notice the smell of rain or anything like that, or like that feels really jarring. Mm-hmm. Right, unless you're playing a weird supernatural game where a storm literally does appear out of nowhere and that's its own thing. So yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. Referencing a point that that Wes made earlier about like if all of your players decide to play druids and rangers, it's like, okay, well, in that case, what I'll just do is be like, hey guys, you seem interested in like outdoor, like environmental stuff. To get to where you need to go, you have to cross this frozen tundra desert. Mm. And like, how are you going to do that? And I'll let them approach it like a problem solving scenario, right? And like, I'm not really interested in like, did you accurately calculate the exact number of calories you're going to need every day? I'm more like, oh yeah, that sounds like a cool plan. Let's roll for it. Mm. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's a great idea. It's nice to present it as like something that might be puzzling, but like has like a solution that they can like find and make it more meaningful in that way, instead of like, you know, everybody roll. Okay, you slept through the night and you are not so tired, like mm-hmm. despite the cold. Like,
yeah, I would say that if you are spending a lot of time on the environment and it doesn't create interesting choices or strategy decisions, then like you might be losing something, right? Like mm-hmm. part of, and certainly this is true for like traditional D&D combat, which I haven't done for a while, but like the purpose of knowing the environment and knowing the terrain is to affect player decision making, because, you know, creative problem solving is really what role-playing games are all about. And like the environment should factor in that somewhere.
Yeah, and I mean, that's like D&D kind of tries to do that with its like millions of different rules for, well, this level of terrain gives you this percent mischance to be hit by arrows, and like this one makes you move at 3/4 speed unless you have a special ability that says otherwise. D&D is certainly attempting to do that. The problem is that in most of this, at least in most combats that I've run into, where the GM has like even bothered to make us a map, those like rules are so like, there's so many of them that they tend to just get forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Has been my experience.
Yeah, it's hard to really like with D&D in particular, right? Like if you're running it, you know, theater of the mind style, which they say, you know, is what fifth edition is encouraging, as opposed to like tile based, like it's hard to keep track of that. Like, where am I? Wait, what am I standing on? You know, like that's kind of a headache for a player to deal with. It's like, you can only move at half speed. And it's like, wait, I forgot I was standing in this puddle. Like,
yeah, like the idea that fifth ed isn't meant to be played with a map, it to me is kind of absurd.
I agree.
There are so many rules in 5th Ed that are like, this gives you 10 more feet of movement in a round. And I'm like, that doesn't matter if I'm not playing on a grid. Nobody is going to keep track of if I'm 10 feet apart from my opponent or not. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, no, that's its own problem. but...
Yeah. So let's dive and talk about things like maps and grids and miniatures.
Mm-hmm.
And things that you could have at the table. I have to say, like, I understand that there's an issue with breaking out the grid for combat, and that tends to lead to a very slow combat. At the same time, I find that I really miss having, like, physical props and miniatures. It's been a long time since I've had, like, a miniature in a game. And that for me, like, added something to have those, mm-hmm. like, visual representations at the table. And certainly it is difficult, it can be very difficult to get any kind of visual representation to that will like fit what you're doing, right? Because you could be doing anything and there's only so many like resources that are easy to get without too much trouble. But I have had some, for instance, one shots that had, you know, some like shiny like purchased tavern grids that were used for effect and some other like maps and things, and I do think that like that added a lot to the feeling of the game. Is that something you guys ever use? Or
yeah, actually back like when I started with third edition, like the kit that I got came with like a generic tavern and a generic like first floor of a house. And like I still have those like large, like, you know, single like tile things, and we still use them, which is kind of funny. I think in the effort to like maintain pace, we've used them less, but definitely for like a boss fight, like I get the tiles out, or I will use it to kind of like set a scene initially. Like I have some decent ones for like a little cityscape and like a small village type thing, so it's kind of fun to like mm-hmm. say, you know, like, here's a map and these are like the places you can go, and I'm not necessarily gonna like move minis around on there and keep track of things, but like it, you're right, it's kind of like a nice like visual anchor. It's like, ah, I am here, I'm like in this place, like I can take what I see in front of me and kind of build off that myself, you know? So mm-hmm. I do enjoy playing it with it. And the people that I regularly play with are do enjoy using the tiles and minis, not exclusively, but definitely like to kind of enhance the games. Oren, mm-hmm. what about you?
Okay, so I'm not going to say that they have no place in games. I have definitely played in some games where the novelty is cool. I mean, I don't use them a lot just because I'm bad at drawing, like really bad at drawing. So like trying to like creating a map that is enough like what I want it to look like is just a huge amount of work. And frankly, I just don't think the benefits that it gives are commensurate with the amount of work it takes.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if I'm like, you know, not if on the rare instance that I run a D&D style system, I will use a grid just because if I don't, characters who took abilities that give them 5 feet of extra reach are kind of being cheated. But for the most part, it's like there's definite value to having like a map, because a map is like a visual thing that the players can reference and like see what it is, and like that makes it more real. Having a grid that you like move pieces around on, like obviously that can have benefit. Chris is talking about it. But I find that I just don't care when I'm like, okay, it's like, I need to get to my enemy. And it's like, I have 30 feet of movement and my enemy is 40 feet away. And I'm like, I just want to fight him, okay? Just let me go over there and fight him. I don't really feel like it is interesting that I can't get over there and fight him because I didn't have quite enough movement, right? Like, that just seems, like, really anticlimactic to me.
Yeah. Okay, so here's a follow-up, then. Let's say that we're... I think if you've got, like, a tile... The tiles are, like, a map in front of you, then, like... whether you're like you downloaded it, drew it yourself, or bought it, like let's say that it's like a wilderness scene, and so like this little map has got like some rocks on it, some trees, some fallen logs. So like if you're playing with minis, you know, there's like kind of like an implied like understanding of like I know that I can get to that tree right there. If you're not playing on a board, then how, as a GM, should you deal with that? It's like you're commencing fighting in like a field or like an open, a glade or whatever.
yeah, glade.
And the character's like, is there a tree near me? And you're like, yes. And then like, how far away is it? It's not that far. Okay, would it provide cover for... Yeah, like there's like a series of questions that like could go back and forth with like how you're imagining the thing, the scene take place, and like maybe what they want to do. Like I'm just curious for like input on like how to run that impromptu. Like, should you just use the improv rule of yes and just like go with it, or like...
Yeah, I tend to go in that direction. It's like, unless it feels like the player is asking for something that's potentially breaking to the story, it's like, yeah, absolutely, there's a tree you can hide behind.
Okay.
Like, you know, using clever tactics, I'll give you a small bonus for that, even if there's not anything in the rules that says you get it.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, my description of environments is like, okay, you know, it gets the job done. But nobody's ever gonna like write home and be like, dear grandmother, this week our GM Oren did an amazing description of the forest and the green trees. It's like, nobody will ever do that for my games, right? That's not my strong suit, so I don't try to focus on it, because like I'm just taking away from the parts that I am good at.
Yeah, I think I can see that, because, you know, if they're even asking those questions, it's because they've already like, I think, come up with a creative problem-solving plan in their head, right, for how they want to deal with the situation. And generally I find that in, you know, good games, the GM always finds a way to reward those kinds of effort. You know, it's not about like, you know, judging good ideas versus bad ideas. You know, it's like, if the player puts into effort into creatively solving the problem, that, like, should always be rewarded in some way. Like, always create results, basically, is what I've found.
Yeah. Another, so like something that I've noticed when in games when I have used minis, with minis, if you're going to use them, I think that you should kind of go all in. Because like a big advantage of having a mini is it is that it looks like your character.
Right.
And like if so like I've definitely noticed that games where we have where the characters the players have minis that actually look like their characters, they demonstrate a lot more interest in what's happening than a game where it's like, oh man, I just need someone to represent like me, so I'm gonna grab this like war machine guy that I have got lying around, even though like my character is a wizard and this guy is like a steamjack dude. You know, it's like, and admittedly that can present some challenges. For example, if you are playing a female character who doesn't have a lot of battle cleavage going on, that can be hard to find a mini that looks like your character.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, not to mention that all that stuff costs money, you know, like.
Yes, that also costs money. But like, I mean, you know, Chris for a while had like a really big miniature collection of just like not game minis, just like cool figures. And it was not, it was generally a lot easier to find something that would like resemble a character that we were playing in that collection. And that made it more fun, I think, if you're going to be using minis.
Yeah, definitely. I think when I think about the minis have kind of a nostalgic value for me, and definitely a strong component of that nostalgic value is having a mini that like you feel like represents your character, right? So that you have like a really strong visual of your character, and that, you know, maybe there's something like childlike about it. It's like, here's, you know, the tavern, and look at my character walk through the tavern, playing with my toys.
Look, but, playing with toys is very important, okay?
Yeah, and I'm a person who likes to paint minis. So for me, like, part of it is it's like if you're doing a long campaign where you're actually, you know, using minis, like individual minis aren't, you know, that expensive, you know, and again, paints can be more expensive, of course. But, you know, if you can you get together and find the right mini and then paint them. And painting is partly nice because then if like you have a mini that is meant for battle cleavage, then you can paint over that and be like, no,
right.
There's not actually cleavage there. But anyway, but that can create a lot of kind of attachment and be very engaging.
So guys, what I asked you about your favorite type of environment at the beginning. So tell me what your favorite kinds of environmental obstacles are to face. Maybe quicksand
to face,
or
as a player, like a giant like wall made of brownies is probably the first one on my list. Yeah, no, I mean like as a I'm always a fan. I will always be a fan of some kind of fast moving waterway, something that is impossible for a human to swim across. Because otherwise, putting water in the way is just a skill test to be like, hey, did you guys remember to take swim? Nobody remembers to take swim. You know, so like, avoid. But like, if it's a fast moving body of water, crossing those is like a significant endeavor, right? Like, you need to put your heads together and be like, okay, guys, so are we going to build a boat, or are we going to try to like caulk the wagon, or ford it? Don't ford it, the oxen will die. Mm-hmm. You know, stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. That's probably my favorite.
Yeah. I would say, for me, I would choose probably an obstacle where you have to kind of find the right path. So it could be, like, and sometimes I do think it's kind of neat when you are trying to, for instance, break into a building, right? And you have to look for an entrance, or maybe you're out in the forest and you have to, like, kind of navigate around, or... you know, something that, or you're, you know, I think something that would be really cool is if, like, you're in a, you know, castle with lots of passageways and you're trying to find looking for hidden passageways. That's definitely fun. So I guess those kinds of things would be my favorite, because I find them interesting. The act of, like, trying to inspect something and see what's there.
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, and like the act of discovery and such.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's kind of fun I'm actually kind of similar. I'm very much in favor of like puzzling situations where like they have the potential to just get lost, but like figure out their own way. So I do like nighttime, foresty, heavily forested type ish areas. You know,
oh yeah, like, that would be those are very just cool.
They're super fun to like run, and like I've gotten like better like back and forth with players when I really like remove like a lot of the visual elements. It's like you're in a forest and it's dark, like, so how are you going mm-hmm. to navigate this? Oh, and by the way, there's probably monsters or like this is gonna happen. So I always think that that's kind of a fun way to do, is deprive them of like, you know, some of their faculties like sight, and then see like how they can work through that.
Yeah, I'm a fan of anything that can be described as the deep woods. Like if you can call it the deep woods, it's like, I think you're on the right track here. Okay, like who knows what's in there? It's all kinds of weird stuff.
Yeah, and there's definitely something really cool about being in a forest where, like, let's say you have, you know, a small lantern or something, but like. Or maybe that's a trade-off. If you turn on the lantern, then your eyes adjust to the light and you can definitely not see anything beyond the lantern, right? Whereas if you turn the lantern off, you have better dark vision, but you still can't see very well. But the point is that if you're carrying a lantern in the middle of the dark woods, well, you see the trees that are, like, within 10 feet of you, and then everything else like that is just blackness. You know,
the real problem with carrying a lantern in the dark woods is that you need to get oil from the Edelwood trees of the Beast Mansion. nice Over the Garden Wall reference there for you.
But then when there's just black and you can't see, it's like anything could be there.
Which is actually kind of nice, because if you're not like, you know, a romantic and can just like espouse like descriptions of woodland beauty, like, you know, the dark is a saving grace for you, right? Like you can see some trees near you, but barely. Like, all right, and scene, I've described it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and speaking of scene, we are out of time for this episode, and so thank you, Wes. This was a great topic. We could talk about the environment and how cool it is, or how it will kill you. So when you run that one shot for us, I'm going to need you to make me that wall of brownies. That's like, I'm going to be expecting.
Here we go.
Right now.
Here's your challenge. Let's do this.
It's on my my character sheet. It's something that I care about. But all right, for those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythgreens.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.